go on to hear the next case, which is Crump versus the People. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Anthony Noble, registration number 33910, and I represent the petitioner, James Crump. The issue in this case, in a nutshell, is whether the trial judge's participation in the plea discussions is reversible error. The trial judge in this case participated in the plea discussions in two ways. First, the judge advised Mr. Crump of the mandatory sentence that would be imposed if he was found guilty at a trial, and then compared that with the discretion that the trial judge would have if Mr. Crump entered a guilty plea. The Court of Appeals agreed with Mr. Crump that the happy judge comment that was made, which after the trial judge made the comparison of the sentence, he then went on to tell Mr. Crumb that I'm not going to be a happy judge if the people tell me we don't have a deal.
I thought that that comment was made after they told him they had a tentative deal or a basic deal but hadn't worked out the details.
Yes.
Is that wrong?
Yes, you're correct, Your Honor. That is right.
Isn't that a difference that's worth thinking about?
I think it is, Your Honor, because at the time when the judge made the comparison, defense counsel said, Your Honor, I think we have an agreement. And the district attorney then explained that they'd reached a tentative sentencing range for the plea agreement. And then the judge said, I'm not going to be a happy judge if the people tell me that we don't have a deal. But at the point that that comment was made, there was no finalized plea agreement. Mr. Crumb wasn't ready at that time to go through the formal providency advisement, and the judge wasn't ready at that point to determine whether or not there was a finalized deal and whether or not Mr. Crumb was entering into that deal knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently.
Well, give me the sequence a little bit, could you? Because I remember seeing it, these discussions were going on throughout the course of a Friday, and I thought that the happy judge comment was toward the end of the day. Is that wrong? He had seen parties a couple of times by then, I think.
It was actually in the middle of the proceedings.
Okay.
These cases had been pending for several years. The first case was almost, well, it was over 4 years old at that point. And the parties entered into a pre-trial conference on the Friday before the first case was going to be heard the following Monday. And the trial judge, the first question he asked was to the district attorney. He asked the district attorney, are you ready to proceed to trial on Monday? And the district attorney said yes. He then asked Mr. Crumb, are you ready to proceed to trial on Monday? And Mr. Crumb said yes. Despite the fact that both parties were ready to proceed to trial on the following Monday, the trial judge then started talking about the plea discussions. He said that I understand that there have been plea discussions in this case, and that was correct because there was an offer on the table at the very beginning of the first case, and it seemed that there wasn't a continuing offer during the pendency of all these cases right up until that pretrial conference. Mr. Crumb hadn't accepted any of the offers that had been made up until that point. So after determining whether both parties were ready to proceed to trial, the trial judge then started talking about the possibility of a plea disposition. And during that conversation, it became apparent that Mr. Crumb was interested in a plea disposition, but only under his terms.
Well, let me ask you this. Remind me, is Mr. Combe acting now pro se?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what the trial judge was trying to do was to make sure he understood that if he went to trial and was convicted, he would be subject to the Habitual Offender Act. And there wouldn't be discretion left in the trial judge to relieve the aspects of that act. Isn't that what the judge was trying to do? Now, whether he properly should be doing that or not, I'd like you to address that. But in the first instance, would you agree with the way I just phrased that? That was what he was trying to do, was to make sure that the plea was knowing, voluntary, intelligent with respect to this habitual criminal aspect of the case.
I would agree to a certain extent, Your Honor, but in this case, that had already been determined. Prior to that pretrial conference, Mr. Crum had been given two Arguello advisements. And during those Arguello advisements, he had been advised of exactly what the consequences would be of being found guilty after a trial on the first case. So he understood the mandatory nature of the counts against him. Another point that I'd like to make on that advice is that when Judge Gahee did give that advice to Mr. Crum, he implied that the whole sentence would be mandatory. He didn't explain that he did actually have some discretion after a trial. He had the discretion, for instance, whether to run the eight counts, the eight habitual sentences, concurrently or consecutively. So he did have some discretion if Mr. Crum did go to trial. The Court of Appeals agreed with Mr. Crum that both the comparison of the sentence and the happy judge comments was a violation of the rule that prohibits judicial participation in plea negotiations. However, the Court of Appeals ruled that any violation of the rule in this case was harmless error. The Court of Appeals accepted that Mr. Crump had preserved this issue in the district court and applied the harmless error standard. Mr. Crum didn't make a contemporaneous objection, but he did file two motions to withdraw his guilty plea. During a hearing on one of those motions, he explained that one of the reasons why he entered the plea was because the judge had told him that he's not going to be a happy judge if there's no plea disposition.
Well, Mr. Noble, and I think this relates back to the question of what we should do with the fact that it was announced that they might have an agreement. The DA thought they had an agreement, but we're still working on sentencing. And it did seem to me that although the defendant did make that comment about and recall the happy judge comment, the thrust of his presentation there seemed rather instead to be, I didn't have enough time to read it and be sure that I was rushed, as opposed to I was pressured. Would you comment on that, and how does that come back into play in terms of whether the happy judge comment had some impact or not?
I agree that Mr. Crum was proceeding pro se on his motions to withdraw his guilty plea, and the focus was more on being rushed and not understanding the lengthy plea agreement. But I don't think that criminal defendants always understand why they enter a plea. And I don't think they always understand the pressure that they're under. So he felt rushed, and he'd been told that if you don't come back with a plea agreement, I'm not going to be a happy judge. That was clearly a consideration of his, because he referred to that during the argument on his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. And the Court of Appeals agreed with him that was an inappropriate comment, that the judge should not have made that comment. It violated the rule against participating in plea discussions. I suppose the question that you're really asking me is, how did that comment prejudice Mr. Crum? And this is a question that's been considered by many appellate courts throughout the country. And in almost every case in which an appellate court has found impermissible judicial participation, they've always found reversible error, whether they apply the harmless error standard or whether they apply the plain error standard.
Mr. Noel, Could you explain what standard and define it that you'd like us to apply in this case, assuming that there was error? Because part of your brief at least reads to me that the way you've just started to argue it, that it's really a structural error, and that's not so. So what's how are we to articulate the harmless error standard? How would you want us to do that? And then how would you apply it?
The harmless error standard was applied by the Court of Appeals, both in the majority opinion and in the dissenting opinion. And I think the dissenting opinion probably gives a clearer test, a clearer analysis. And in that opinion, the dissenting judge said that there are two parts to the harmless error test. The first part is, you know, was there a violation of the rule that prohibits judicial participation in the plea negotiations? The second part is, did that affect the substantial rights of the defendant? The Court of Appeals analysis doesn't really go much further than that, and I think that's where this court needs to look at some of the authority coming from other jurisdictions, especially the Federal Circuit. In the Federal Circuits, they've actually articulated a test to determine what is it that affects substantial rights of the defendant. And the test that they've articulated in the majority of opinions coming from other jurisdictions is whether the judge's participation in the plea discussions may reasonably be viewed as having been a material factor affecting a defendant's decision to plead guilty. So the issue there was, is it a material factor affecting Mr. Karem's decision to plead guilty? What indicates that it was a material factor is the timing of the advisement and the decision to plead guilty. Almost immediately on being advised of the consequences of going to trial, defense counsel says, I think we have an agreement. I think that this timing is key here.
Could I ask you, before you go on too much about the timing, to explain how you understand the term a material factor? What does that mean?
And
what I'm looking at is we've used the term differently in a number of contexts, but particularly we talk about constitutional materiality with regard to, you know, ineffective assistance or failure to disclose or those kind of things. By material, do you mean here would he have entered the plea but for the interference of the trial judge?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a different test, and that's generally the test that the courts in other jurisdictions apply under a plain error standard. The but-for test is generally applied to determine whether the violation affected the substantial rights of the defendant when a court is applying a plain error analysis. Under the harmless error standard, it's not really a but-for. It's, you know, is it one of the factors that could have led to the decision to plead guilty? And I think that the timing in this case indicates that it was one of the factors that led him to plead guilty in this case.
And I appreciate the various ways in which we've expressed what harmless error is, what plain error is, how we do that. But here, you're talking particularly about whether the judge's interference was material. And then you started to explain about the timing and why you thought it was material. Could you tell me what it means to be material in this context?
I'm not sure that I can really answer that question, Your Honor, because all the opinions that I've read, all the opinions from the other jurisdictions, once they've determined that there has been impermissible judicial participation in the plea negotiations, they have then determined that there is reversible error. So I think that what that tells the court is that appellate judges are probably not in the best position to determine what is and what is not a material factor, other than by looking at some of these key indicators, like the timing of the decision to plead guilty. If a decision to plead guilty immediately follows a judge's comparison of a post-plea and post-trial sentence, then that indicates that that was a material factor in the decision to plead guilty.
And why is that? Why would that connection mean it's material? What is there about being material that indicates that connection would show it's material? I mean, what are we trying to decide? I guess maybe we're not the right ones to decide it, but what are we trying to decide?
I think that, you know, it's an extremely difficult position for a judge to be in. I don't think it's easy for a judge to put himself or herself in the shoes of a criminal defendant, an indigent criminal defendant facing a powerful trial judge. And I think that because of that, other courts defer to the fact that this kind of comparison is inherently coercive. There's no doubt that the judge has power. He has the power over sentencing. The defendant doesn't have that power, doesn't have that money.
May I interrupt you right there? I know the time is short, but maybe you've touched on the point here. You say it's inherently coercive. So, in effect, are we asking the question, was the plea effective or was it coerced as a result of what the trial judge did? And if it wasn't coerced, is it harmless?
No, Your Honor. I think that I don't think you have to actually look for coercion. I don't think that that really is the key, but that is an indicator because this comparison is inherently coercive, then there's no real certainty about whether or not the plea was entered voluntarily. So what I'm doing is I'm asking you to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals. Mr. Crum is serving an 80-year sentence as a result of this plea. Because of the trial judge's participation in the plea negotiations, I don't think that the people of this state can have any confidence that that plea was entered voluntarily under a fair and impartial judicial system.
So we're really back to the voluntariness issue here. And the remedy being sought is what? Withdrawal of the guilty plea, restoration of the ability to go to trial?
Yes, Your Honor, withdrawal of the guilty plea and remand for a trial.
And what you're really doing is asking for us to exercise our supervisory jurisdiction to enforce our rule against participation of a judge in the plea proceedings.
That's correct, Your Honor. Otherwise, we have a rule prohibiting judicial participation, but it's not being enforced. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt, attorney number 13803. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'm going to begin with the error analysis, not only because it's the issue on cert, but also because if this court finds no prejudice, the issue of whether or not these remarks violate Rule 11 need not be analyzed. It's sort of like the Strickland test. If you find no prejudice, you don't have to deal with the rest of it. The correct standard of review in this case is plain error. The petitioner did not object erroneously to any of the remarks of the judge, nor did he raise this issue in his two motions below to withdraw the plea. The reason why that's important is we don't have a personal statement from this petitioner that he took the plea because of the comments by the judge.
Ms. Pratt, let me ask a couple of preliminary questions to this argument, and that is, did you make the argument that it was plain air standard review to the Court of Appeals?
I did.
And the other thing that I wanted to know is, if the defendant had raised this adequately in the motions to withdraw the plea, would you agree that that would be the appropriate time or a sufficiently appropriate time to make the objection, essentially?
I think it could be either way. I think the courts have talked.
I guess what I'm saying is it necessary for an objection to have been made when the plea was entered in order to preserve the issue?
I'm not really sure. In the typical trial situation, you have to object contemporaneously, and I think that's a good standard. This defendant was pro se, or the petitioner was pro se. I don't think he gets a pass because he's pro se, but I view it that it has to be contemporaneous. I think that's right. I think it has to be done either at the time he takes the plea because he's having a direct colloquy with the judge, or it has to be at the time that the comments are made. I think the reason why I mentioned the issue in the two motions to withdraw his plea is we just don't have a statement on this record that the petitioner took the plea because of the statements that were made by the judge.
So you're saying if you look at any of those times, you don't have the objection.
Is that right? That's right.
Can I ask you a question about the motion to withdraw then, since we're talking about that?
Yes, sir.
Does it seem to you that there is a different standard here? Does it make any difference that the defendant actually filed to withdraw under Rule 32 before the plea became final by sentencing?
I think that he needed to allow the judge to make a ruling, because that's what we're appealing. I mean, that's what it's an appeal from. if I understand your question correctly.
But, and maybe I'll, let me narrow it just a little bit. In other 32D contexts, you know, we've had a number of cases where we've talked about the standard for deciding whether a defendant should have been allowed to withdraw his plea if he raises that by motion before the plea, before he's actually sentenced and the judgment becomes final. And haven't we said that it's a matter of discretion? And so where he files a 32D, the question should be, did the trial judge abuse his discretion in denying that? And although we've narrowed it in other contexts, we generally say, don't we, in all of the cases, that the judge does abuse his discretion if there is a fair and just reason that he should allow the withdrawal. How does that play into the question of plain or harmless error, when the objection had to be made? If it's a 32D case, should we be just looking at whether the judge abused his discretion and not allowing him to withdraw?
Ultimately, yes. But the way this works is, if there is a violation of Rule 11, or even if there isn't, if we're just doing a plain error analysis, plain or harmless, and the court finds prejudice, then that constitutes a just and fair reason for the withdrawal of the plea. If there isn't prejudice, and the petitioner would have entered his plea anyway on the record, then there isn't a just and fair reason to withdraw the plea. So I think that's how it works.
Okay. I guess I all of a sudden got a little bit confused. I thought that at some point the defendant also raised some additional issues, complaining about Judge McGahee's involvement with the church and that kind of thing, or the church that was defrauded.
Now,
was that so? What happened is they entered the plea. Sentencing was put off for a while, but before sentencing, he filed his first motion to withdraw.
Correct.
Then there was sentencing. Then there was the second. Well, then, with respect to the first motion to withdraw, then Judge McGahee got off the case, right?
Right. What happened was, before sentencing, in front of Judge McGahee at the sentencing hearing, he filed the motion to withdraw his plea. When that motion was denied, he threatened the DA, and advisory counsel came forward, told the judge, and everybody was off the case. Then it was set in front of another judge. And
he threatened the DA.
He said, "You're a dead man," I think.
Okay. That happened before he was sentenced.
Yes.
And Judge McGahee also got off and didn't sentence him.
Correct.
So then it went to another judge.
It went to another judge. He filed another motion to withdraw. She denied it, and then she sentenced him.
Okay, and at no time through any of those proceedings did he bring up the happy judge problem?
Correct. In this context, correct. He brought it up in the context of, I was very rushed into taking the plea. I had to take this plea, and I wanted more time to talk this over with the district attorney, but it was ongoing. Plain error is articulated in Colorado as error that affects the substantial rights of the petitioner. The United States Supreme Court has defined plain error in the context of Rule 11 in the Dominguez-Benitez case by saying that what affecting the substantial rights means is that the petitioner has to show a reasonable probability that, but for this error, the petitioner would not have entered his guilty plea. Here are the background facts that I think shape the analysis of error. First is that the petitioner is pro se. The second is the large and complicated nature of the plea arrangement. It was 12 or 13 entire cases disposing of 50 separate felony counts. The petitioner had delayed the decision for at least 4 years, and on one occasion, the district attorney had even flown in witnesses over the weekend for a trial that ultimately didn't take place. So there was a lot of dilatory action on behalf of this petitioner. The judge's statements took place on the last business day before the plea expired, but right before the plea expired. The negotiations were still ongoing. It wasn't started and stopped and started and stopped and revised by the judge, as the petitioner has tried to argue, but rather, over a period of weeks, the construct, what the plea arrangement was eventually going to look like in terms of the pleas that he was going to plead to, what he was willing to admit to, what he was not willing to admit to, were put in place, because there was no way they could put together a plea deal this complicated in the space of a single afternoon. Now, the statements referencing the habitual criminal laws also had a very specific context. The very first thing, the most important fact, I think, in this whole case, is that the petitioner said, when the judge said, "Are you ready to go to trial?" he did say yes. But then he said, a little bit later, maybe on the next page, he said, "I don't really want to go to trial, but I don't feel like I have a choice." And that's when the judge started having conversations with him, telling him he did have a choice. But unlike a lot of the circuit courts that have reversed it because of judicial participation, this petitioner was predisposed to taking a plea. He wanted to take a plea. He was facing, as a pro se defendant, having himself to try these cases. And I think that's a very important fact, because he was already going in that direction. The conversation about habitual sentencing was initiated at the petitioner's request of the judge, asking him to intervene between himself and the district attorney. The judge did not threaten the petitioner with consequences, did not express a preference, did not attempt to shape the terms of the agreement. He didn't even want to know about it. And constantly, or maybe not constantly, but two or three times, he reiterated his neutrality on the record. In this context, as found by the Court of Appeals, the discussion of the habitual criminal laws and how they applied, in their words, merely explained the difference between discretionary sentencing and habitual criminal sentencing. Moreover, the petitioner was thoroughly informed of his rights and consequences during a thorough providency hearing, and he made a knowing and voluntary waiver of his right to go to trial on the record. The burden of proof in this case is on the petitioner, and he has not shown that the conduct of the judge demonstrated a reasonable probability that but for the judge's remarks, he would not have taken the plea.
Ms. Pratt, could you assume that if we instead of applying plain error, we apply harmless error, how would you look at the case?
Well, the harmless error analysis would be similar, except I would have the burden of proof, or the people would have the burden
right.
of proof. That would mean that I would have to show that I would substitute likely, a reasonable likelihood that but for the judge's remarks, the petitioner would not have taken the plea, or would have taken the plea, I'm sorry. So I have to show there's a likelihood that he would have taken the plea anyway. I don't like that reasonable probability stuff.
Ms. Pratt, what about when Judge McGahee, not the happy judge comment before that, when he said, "Well, let me basically just talk to you as a person, not as a judge." What, you know, the paragraph or so that I'm referring to?
I do.
Doesn't that portion of the transcript seem to indicate it can be read both ways, I suppose, but what's your take on that? Doesn't he seem to be telling the defendant that, look, I'm not going to have near the discretion if you don't plead that I do right now, and sort of implicitly it works to your benefit, therefore, if you would take the deal right now?
I don't think so, because I think we have a specific context for this, and I think that because of the complication of what was going on either side, and this is an anomalous case. I mean, it's very interesting for this reason, and that is he was pleading to 50 counts, or pleading to 12 or 13 cases, and he was only going to trial on one. And I don't think the judge was trying to express his preference one way or the other. I think he was just trying to give him that information. Those specific remarks where the judge is trying to distance himself from the whole thing and take off his robe and not be a judge but be a friend, I think if anything is improper within everything here, I think that is. I think the judge can't distance himself from his position.
So you would say that when he said, "Well, let me just talk to you as a human being," that for sure is improper.
I don't know. I would say that if there's any impropriety, it's that sentence.
Uh-huh.
Nothing else but that sentence.
Right.
I don't think he should have done that.
Right. And then pretty shortly, I'm not sure that he ever kind of switched hats, is when he made the happy judge comment.
No, it's when he made the habitual sentence comments.
He talked about that, and then...
And then they made the... Then
like on the very next page, he says, "I'm not going to be a happy judge if the people tell me we don't have a deal."
That's correct, but they had already come to an agreement, And in context, I think that happy judge comment has been taken out of context, because in context, what's happened is there have been weeks and weeks of negotiations. The petitioner finally decides that he's going to take the plea. And then the petitioner says, oh, I'm not happy really with the framework that we already have in place, sort of signaling that there's going to be more maybe dilatory stuff. And so what the judge does, and he puts the burden on the prosecutor, because he says to him, I'm not going to be happy if the people come back and tell me we don't have a deal, meaning he's trying to say, you make it work, Mr. Prosecutor. If he wants to substitute one charge for another or do one thing over another, do it, because you have an agreement, you've got everything in place. We're only talking now about charges. And I think if there's any coercion, I think it's coercive towards the prosecution.
Go ahead, please.
All right, thank you. Let me back you up just a little bit to where it seems to me this conversation starts and see what your comment is on that. And that is where I think Mr. Noble drew attention to this towards the beginning of his argument, where the judge asks if the people are ready to proceed to trial, and they say yes. And he asks whether Mr. Crum is ready to proceed to trial, and he says yes. And I think the argument is that's kind of the end of it then. The judge, however, proceeds to say, I know there's been a lot of discussion about dispositions, and I don't know, I haven't looked at record prior to this, so I don't know why the judge is aware of that. But in any event, he proceeds to say, I'm not going to inject myself into that, except to say, which seems to rather imply a somewhat limited injection into that. Comment on that, because I'm concerned about impropriety at that point in the discussion as well.
In between the defendant saying, I want to go to trial, and the remarks that you just cited to, the petitioner said, I really don't want to, but I feel I have no choice.
Maybe you could call my attention to that, because what I read you was continuous. In the transcript, morning session, Friday, October 21st, page 2. I don't believe that, unless my transcript is incorrect, was something injected in the middle of what I just quoted to you.
You're right. That's what happened. I'm talking about
Yeah, I think there may have been a later discussion as well, and I suppose you can comment on whether that later discussion is inappropriate. But this is the opening discussion that I'm referring to, at least as far as the transcript that I've looked at.
All right.
Morning of Friday, October 21st.
I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. I'm trying to say in the middle of page 3, or no, top of page 3, right after those remarks, he says, that's correct, it'll be off the table if you don't do this by the end of the day. And then he says, do you want to still proceed even though this is going to be off the table? And the defendant says, yes, I feel like I don't have any choice. It's not what I want to do, but I don't have any choice. So he really wants to plead.
Well, but that's the second time he's asked. Essentially, he's being asked, are you sure you want to go to trial?
Well,
my question is, when he says, I'm ready for trial, I don't know how the judge says anything else beyond that without at least partially injecting himself into the negotiations. He hasn't been told at that point in time. I mean, contrary to what you were originally suggesting, it's not, are you ready to go to trial? Well, yes, but I don't have any choice. Help me with the plea negotiations. He says, yes. It's the judge that then goes, that proceeds to say, I understand there's been discussion. I want to make this limited injection into the negotiations. What do you do with that remark?
I think it's ministerial. I mean, I think what it is he just says, and I mean, this is usually what happens when you start your pretrial conference. You say, are we ready to go to trial, or are we going to take a plea? And I think, especially in these circumstances where this has gone on and on and on and on and on, the judge wants to make sure that if we're committing our day to the plea, if we're going to commit our day to doing a pretrial conference, we have to make sure that everything else is off the table. Where are we going? That's how I would interpret it. But I agree with you. I got the timing wrong. The people would respectfully request that the ruling that affirms the petitioner's convictions be affirmed. Thank you for your time.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.